The label on the package says product of the USA, but the rules say what is in the package could have come from anywhere. That leads us to ask once again, how can we regain control of our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1344th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Dijon who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com or any of a number of other places, including SantaCruzVoice.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What. Folks, follow along, and it isn't going to be easy. You have heard it said that we are what we eat. Makes sense, right? Whatever we put into our belly gets broken down into the constituent elements we call nutrients, which are then assimilated into our bodies. We are what we eat. But if it is true that we are what we eat, it then follows that we are what we eat eats as well. That makes sense. What else could we be than what we eat eats? If one is curious about what one is becoming, then one needs to know what he or she eats eats as well. I told you it would be tough to follow it. Now, if one is eating a carrot from one's garden, it's pretty easy to know that what that carrot ate, because you fed that carrot by feeding the soil in which the carrot grew up to be a food. And so you know, you did it. But if one is eating a hamburger, or even an impossible pretend burger, how can one know what the cow or the soybeans that contributed to the burger ate? One could look at the label, which might say product of the USA, and feel reassured that anything that is a product of the USA would be good to eat, because the USA has rules and regulations about how animals are raised. But when it comes to the labeling of meat, World Trade Organization rules and regulations predominate, and therefore what is in the burger may have come from a number of different animals, from a number of different ranches, and from a number of different countries. And the same could be said for the soybeans from which the patented pretend burgers are made. If such is the case, how then can we know what one will become if there is no way to know what the food that one eats ate to become the food that it is? What one could do is to source food directly from the local farmer who grew the food. I call it food with its farmer's face on it. This proximity to the source of food allows one to look into the farmer's eyes and see what the food he or she has grown has eaten, and therefore what one will become. With that in mind, I would like to introduce you to my source of bacon, sausage, and bone tea. Join me as we head out to Hollister, California, to meet Jack and Sarah Kimmick, California Kurabuta pasture-raised pork. One of these days, I'm going to get Kurabuta right. Jack, help me out.
Michael, we talked with some folks from Japan, from the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, and they say Kurabuta as if it's one syllable. So Kurabuta. You got me there.
Kurabuta, like that. Hey, kind of rolls right off the tongue. Kurabuta. Yeah. Sarah?
Kurabuta.
Would you give?
They say it like it's Crow Buddha. And that does make it a little Crow Buddha.
Crow Buddha. Okay. Well, there it is. And so let's say, what is, Jack, what is Kurabuta?
Well, for Kurabuta is a Japanese for black pig. And the Queen of England sent a herd of their prized Berkshires over to Japan as a gift, and it soon became the premium table meat of Japan. And so, like the Wagyu beef, then they have Kurabuta pork. And so when we started our farm 12 years ago or so, we wanted to go with a heritage breed because they're smart and they know how to handle the elements, and they produce really good meat. And so we went with Berkshire, started off with two pregnant gilts. And within a month, we had 22 pigs. And 12 years later, we ended up with, I don't know, our highest volume was a little over 300. And now we're at about a 170.
Mm-hmm. And always looking for the right blend of numbers, right, for the marketplace. So,
indeed.
Sarah, what is pasture-raised pork? Ladies and gentlemen, by the way, we are at the California Curubuda Pasture-Raised Pork Ranch in Hollister, California. So if you hear some shuffling about, it's because they're Sarah and Jack are feeding the pigs or feeding the chickens or something. So because they're farmers. They're real-life farmers, and they're doing real-life farming today. So pasture-raised pork, you know, we're all familiar with the industrialization of the pork food chain, in which it the whole operation is dominated by companies like Smithfield Farms, which in fact is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party. And what they have figured out how to do is raise a lot of pork in a little tiny space. And so how does that differ from food that we would rather eat? Well, what is pasture-raised pork, Sarah?
Well, it's pork, pigs that are allowed to roam free. And in our case, they have a waterway as well as a pasture, which is great for them because in the summer they can cool off anytime they want. And we, because a pasture-raised pig is extremely lean, we supplement their pasture with some probiotic food that's proprietary, and we also grow barley sprouts for them. So barley sprouts are like a superfood, and they really love it. I have a lot of great pictures of them enjoying it. They actually look like they're smiling, and they eat the whole thing, root mass, the sprout and all, and it's about 7 inches of sprout and almost as much root mass. It's very, very nutritious for them.
Well, it would seem to me, I might be wrong, but I will bet folks like Smithfield Food have an economist nutritionist who has figured out how to feed the pigs, the pork, just exactly what they need to get by and no more or no less. Would I be wrong in that assessment, Jack?
Very accurate. Actually, there's a company in Canada that they can take a newborn pig and bring it to slaughter weight of around 250 pounds in 3 months. And they do that through genetic work and also through just there's food in front of them constantly. So it's not a life for a very intelligent animal, so that's why we went with pasture. Our pigs have never seen concrete except for one day, and actually... They really are very relaxed when they go into freezer camp. So it's one of those things. It's a totally different way of raising animals.
Jack says the Curubuda are very intelligent. How does that become manifest to you, Sarah?
Well, you have to figure out what they like and how to manage them that way, because they're big, strong animals. And you have to be able to contain them so they don't get on other people's property, and to make them do what you need, like they need to move from one pasture to another or to get into or something like that. But they learn fast, and you find the things that motivate them. Food is one. They like to procreate. And so those are motivating factors that you kind of take advantage of.
And did you say, you kind of faded out there, Sarah. Did you say that they actually enjoy procreating? Is that what I heard?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, good for them. That puts them right up there on the scale of smart to me then. So tell us a little bit about your farm, because you not only raise animals, you raise kids and you raise a community out there. So tell us a little bit about the Kimmich family farm. Jax?
Well, you know, we're off grid. We've been off grid since 2007. And we just really wanted to create a place, like a vacation place for us. So that's what we've done.
While making it as sustainable as possible, self-sustainable. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is a job these days, for sure. Describe the land there a little bit for us.
Well, we've got, we manage about 33 acres. We've got a water table, so that creates its own intricacies, I guess. We have flooding periodically, and we sort of manage things so that the flooding doesn't have a great impact on the land or on the pigs.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit, Jack. Can you kind of shuffle over closer to the Wi-Fi or something?
Okay.
There you go.
Let's see here.
And then Sarah can continue the description of your property.
Yeah, not all of it is ours, but having the waterway is a huge advantage, even though we do get it. Some of it's in the lowlands and gets flooded about every 5 or 6 years. But that we have an abundant water supply, and that's a wonderful thing. That's a huge advantage. And it's, when we bought the property, we noticed it was designated as prime farmland by the county. And that's something that we were looking for, is good soil. And we've, over the years since the late 90s, been adding compost to it, you know, truckload on truckload. And we run a small compost facility here for our personal use.
Mm-hmm. And Jack, what difference, are you there, Jack?
Yes, sir.
Good. What difference does compost make on the soil and on the food for the pigs?
Oh, my gosh. The compost adds the organic matter to the soil, and plants thrive. We have no real pathogens that are causing hardship for the pigs. We really don't have a pig operations have worms. And with our selective pasture rotation, with our chickens that follow the pigs around, and the system that we've got going here, the vet told us that, you know, we really don't need to do any more checks because we've got a good system, and we don't have worms, and that's a huge thing because it detracts from the carcass
the health
mentality. And so it just gives us a good carcass.
Wow. So that's a pretty big deal then.
It's huge.
Pretty big. And you think about those hogs, those pigs. Are they hogs or pigs?
Well, I think it sounds friendly.
Both. Okay. Depends if we have any that get ornery.
All right. Well, I was just going to remark at the difference of those Smithfield Foods hogs in those confinement animal operations, where you know you have to feed them a whole bunch of antibiotics to keep the disease down, because otherwise they're all going to catch something and we're going to lose the whole crop. So you have to keep them all pumped up on antibiotics, and that's what gets into the bacon. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Jack and Sarah Kimmick. We're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we're going to keep looking for what's in the Kimmick's food. I'm excited, aren't you? Because it's in us. All right. We're going to take a quick break here.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Jack and Sarah, I got to looking at my archives, and I see that we last talked way back in Food Chain Radio number 1200, which puts us in August 2019, which meant that we were going into some very auspicious times. I remember catching COVID on November of 2019, which I think was very early in the cycle, but I couldn't believe, what the heck is this? It's a real strange thing. But the stuff swept across our nation and across our world and had turned everything upside down. So I'm curious how it impacted life on the family farm. Sarah?
Well, because an essential business, it really didn't have a lot of impact. We just had to follow protocols for sales events that were a little cumbersome, especially at first. And a lot of private events didn't happen, of course, because people couldn't gather in large groups. But other than that, it didn't have a lot of impact, because what we mostly do is sell what I call custom wholesale. People buy a whole or a half pig from us. It goes to a processor that they're totally in control of. So if they like a lot of bacon, they can have that. Or if they like a lot of pork chops or a lot of sausage, you know, they get to dictate how their pig is cut and wrapped. And so because of the nature of our business, it really didn't affect it that much. And the custom wholesale is the direction we have always been aiming for anyway. We really like retail sales events, because it's so fun to talk to the customers who eat our meat, but they're kind of slow movers in terms of selling a lot of pork.
Right.
Because you sell at a time, and it's not as workable when you have a small farm with only two people operating it.
Yeah, and a lot of work to go to all of the retailers to deliver your product as well. Jack, you also do barbecues, don't you? Special events for people?
Yes, actually, my son, he has Meat Knife Fire, and he's a barbecue guy. So we go and we support him and help him, but he's the one that sets it up. And he did the Kinship Center White Party three or four years ago. He's done weddings and just finished a wine event.
Wine club, yeah.
So just out of curiosity, if you're thinking about having an event, how do you go about doing the barbecues? Do you roast a whole pig or part of the pig, or do people get a choice?
Yeah, it just depends on the size of the party. And his smoker, he can do like 200-plus pound pigs at once. So he can take care of the big parties or even the small, you know, 40-pound roasters and stuff. But yeah, he roasts them and smokes them basically for about 20 hours and spends all night babysitting them and turns out some delicious pork.
I'm hungry. Just thinking about it. Woo, yeah. How big, how many people can one barbecued pig feed?
Well, we sort of guess about 100 pound per person. And so what we've never heard people say is, oh my gosh, I had too much pork left over. What we've heard people say is, oh, I wish we would have gone bigger. With all this effort and all the work and the excitement, they had no leftovers. So we try to err on the high side, and we've never had a dissatisfied customer.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of fun, and a very, you know, when you have an event like that, it's really precious to have something to focus everybody's attention on, and sometimes it's music, and sometimes it's a keg of beer or whatnot, but boy, when you put food like that on the table, you're really going to capture and hold some attention and make an event a lot of fun. And
that looks like a splendid medieval feast, and Tom really does a good job. He always has some kind of green decoration, and he roasts pineapples along with a pig and cuts and serves them too, and it's very nice. It's a very good presentation.
He's well, got good. A big black walnut cutting table that he puts the pig out on. It's beautiful.
And what is the first to feast? The eyes, of course. So when it's when it's there and being cut up, people can look at it and see it and gaze upon it and get the juices flowing. And by the time everything's ready to be eaten, everybody's ready to eat it. So,
definitely.
So it sounds to me like you take great care in putting the right kinds of food into your hogs. And how do you compare that? I mean, how do you sell people on the fact that what is what they are eating is something really special and not just a Smithfield hog that came out of the factory?
Well, you know, Mike. Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I wanted to emphasize the fact that they don't get any commercial animal feeds. So all the junk and garbage that's normally put into animal feeds is never seen by our pigs. We also avoid all corn and soy because it's a crop that has such a high level of genetic modification. So we just do an end run around that by just never having it. So that's why we try to supplement. We also occasionally get truckloads of vegetables or fruits from local trucking companies and through our own truck that we drive around, our farm truck. Mm-hmm. But they actually have a very nice, varied diet, and we grow some things here. About 7 years ago, we started growing wet pennywort in the waterway, and that's a plant that the pigs love. It's very nutritious. It's high in omega-3s, and they can kind of self-feed on it. And a lot of it got washed away in the last flood, and it was really diminished by the drought previous to that. But now it's making a comeback. So we try to take advantage of any natural resource we can.
And you don't use commercial food? Now, I had a pug named Duke who was having trouble around about 15 years of age, maybe even earlier than that. His hair started falling out, and I looked up the average age of a pug, and it was 11 years old, and Duke's 15. I thought, well, Duke's not got long to go here, but we stopped feeding him dog food, commercial dog food, and started making food for him. His hair grew back, and he lived to 20.5.
Oh, my goodness. That's an old dog.
That's an old dog. But he was, very healthy to the end. Now, I'm certain it was because we took him off dog food. And if you think about how commercial feed is made, they use the cheapest ingredients, and then they cook it. And what happens to the nutrients when you cook something like that so that you can put it in a bag? There's not much left, is there?
You know, Michael, when we started off, we started with our herd. We were buying from a local mill, and they got the grain, and they ground it, and they turned it into pellets and all this stuff. And one day I go to pick it up, and I put it, when I'm carrying it, it smelled like cat pee. And I went in there and I said, went back and I said, hey, this stuff's all wet with cat pee. And they go, oh, well, it's not going to hurt anything. And I'm like, okay, you wouldn't eat it. So we started looking at what else was put in feed. And then that led us down a search engine. And I ran across a guy by the name of John Kennedy. And he is the food... he's the food scientist for several huge companies here in California. And John enlightened me on what was allowable and how much and whatnot. And after all that, we thought, there's got to be a better way of finding food for the pigs because we live in the salad bowl of the world. And so we started networking with these companies and picking up leeks and black the cull vegetables, Brussels sprouts, you name it, tons and tons. And so that's how we grew our herd, giving them good food. And as soon as an animal gets corn and soy, and I'm sure it's the same with people, but we found out that the omega-3s decrease and the omega-6s increase. And so every time we got a little more knowledge and found out some true facts, we modified our feeding, and as a result, the chefs say it best. The facility that slaughters our pigs, they told me, they came up and they said, we love your pigs. And I said, how come? And he said, they smell so good. The carcasses smell good. And I said, okay, what do bad carcass smells like? I had no idea. And they said, well, it smells like what comes out of the back end of them because they live in that stuff. And it's just terrible. And so they let me go into the hanging area where the meat was, and they said, smell this pig. And I smelled it. It really did not smell good at all. And then said, now smell this pig. And it was our pig. And it was huge. It was a huge difference. It just smelled like, you know, cold meat. It was, it just did not have that nasty smell. So
are you
it's just a matter of keeping them.
Yeah, go ahead. You talked about the difference between omega-3 and omega-6s. So go through that one more time, okay?
Okay, so omega-3s, those oils are...
a lot more volatile.
Yeah, they will go rancid really quick. And so omega-6s, they can last a long time. And so when you go down your aisle in the grocery store and you grab a box of food, you look at it, it has predominantly omega-6s because that can live in that box for a long time. When you go down and you're buying ready to eat food that's farmers produced, most of the time it's going to be a little higher in omega-3s. It just depends on what they feed. So there have been studies done and people have had their meat assayed, I guess, to find out what nutrient value. And pasture raised, no corn, no soy, tends to have higher omega-3s than omega-6s.
Now, but nutritionally, what difference does that make when our food eats the omega-3s and omega-6s? What difference does that make in our body?
Yeah, well, it's garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you put garbage in your pig and then you eat that, it's like you're going to be getting garbage. But a very interesting thing we found out is we talked with people in other countries and they're dealing with fat. And it turns out that fat in the United States is a terrible thing. They sell people how bad the fat is.
American Heart Association, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what happens is all the antibiotics that they give these animals that live in CAFO operations, that's a confined animal feeding operation, that all the antibiotics gets locked up. A lot of it gets locked up in the fat. And so we keep all of our fat on our pigs. We like having them butchered with the skin on, with the fat, because it's so delicious, but it adds so much to our bodies, to our health. And so that was the big goal. Oh, fat's bad. So butchers trim all the fat off and leave a little bit, you know, but they're just trimming off the leftover antibiotics. With our pigs, they've never had medications, no antibiotics, no vaccinations, no nothing. We just have to make sure that they live a really good life and, you know, keep the crows away from them. And we just don't have the problems. And our vet was very surprised. He just said, man, you guys have a great herd. Whatever you're doing, keep it up. So.
And what you were doing was feeding them good food, giving them fresh air and sunshine, allowing them to live a happy lives, and actually kind of being their partner, it seems.
Yeah, talk about Temple Grandin.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, Temple Grandin is such a great asset to, you know, our feeding operations and our handling operations and worldwide. And so when we first started loading pigs, it would take us, oh my gosh, we could take 2 hours trying to get pigs loaded because they're out on pasture. It's not like they're in a pen. You open up this door and walk them through and load them up. These are out in pasture. So you got to herd them in someplace and then you confine them and all this stuff. And when we found Temple Grandin's methods and we started developing, our hold pens that way, Sarah and I can load 20 pigs in 12 minutes. And it's just so easy. When we arrive at the harvest facility, those pigs are asleep in their bedding with full bellies and hydrated and just content. And it's such a different appeal. You know, the whole atmosphere is so different. And we had to go through five different harvesting facilities in California before we found one that treated our animals with respect and didn't poke him around and push him and hurt, you know, really get them all riled up with the adrenaline prior to harvest. So hats off to the folks down there in Fresno. They do a great job for us, and they really respect all the animals they deal with. They just do a really good job. So that's what we're happy with. There you
go. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what is in your food? What does your food eat that finds its way into your food that finds its way into you? Because we are what we eat, eats. This is the Food Chain Radio program, Michael Olson. When we come back, I have a big question to ask Jack and Sarah. Our good friend once said that there should be no government between a farmer and his customers. So that's an issue that sounds like fun to me. So we'll pick that up when we come back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with the Kimmix, California Kurabuta.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. We are looking into, you know, what they say. They say, we are what we eat. Well, okay, makes all kinds of sense to me. But in thinking about that, I got to thinking, well, if that's the case, then we are what we eat eats as well. So that's what we're exploring today. And how on earth are we supposed to get control of our food? Joel Salatin suggests that there should not be a government between a farmer and his or her customer. I got to thinking I got to thinking that makes a lot of sense to me. Because if I can get close enough to a farmer to see what's in his eyes or her eyes, they can see what's in my eyes, too. So we get a partnership going here where it's the farmer and me and the farmer. And yet, what need is there for government to step in between the two of us? And yet there the government is, standing between the Kimmix and the Olsons. Jack and Sarah, how many ways does the government stand between the two of us?
Well, one thing that we had to do is shut down all our retail sales, because if we do not have our pig processed start to finish in a USDA facility, we cannot legally sell it to the public. They could fine us and confiscate all our inventory if we do that. So we didn't want to do that. So that's why we now do only custom wholesale, because it's the government is making it harder and harder for small operations to have any kind of prosperity. They're regulated just like the big boys, and their needs and are so much different. And it seems like the government is against small farms instead of only allow huge agribusiness to build dignifies.
Jack, how is it that four processors came to own 80% of the beef in America? How did four businesses come to control 80% of the beef in America?
You know, Michael, when things start off, they start off with people's interests in mind. And then as they get bigger, I think corruption grows, and it's all about the money. So I don't want to say too much, but my feeling towards this whole thing is that the small farmer, he cares about what he puts out there, because this is his business. He's not going to put out bad meat. He's going to take and produce the best product he can to put it to his customers, because if you start producing bad meat, nobody's going to buy it and you're out of business. So when we have all these restrictions and the USDA, you know, I think at one time they really had a good mission, and now they sort of lax the rules. We can have one burger that could have multi-species of meat in it from different countries. It just doesn't make any sense to buy a, you know, a 500-pound box or of meat and know that it's from one farm. It's almost unheard of now when they have these huge farms. They just bring all these cows in, process them, and it's just amazing.
And the way the World Trade Organization labeling rules work, a label on that big box of burgers could say product of the USA, and like you were saying, Jack, that meat could be from any number of animals, from any number of ranches, from any number of countries, and it could all be ground up together, and so you never do know what you eats. You have no way of knowing. It's completely exactly. gone. Now, the way I always describe that is through economies of scale. Let's say the Kimmicks have 100 hogs, and let's say Smithfield Food has 10 million hogs, and an important government rule or regulation is pending before the committee. And let's say it would cost, geez, $10 million to influence that decision. So you have to donate it to somebody's, you know, grandmother's birthday party or whatever. So now $10 million for the Kimmicks, that's $100,000 a hog. So the chance of the Kimmicks being able to influence that decision, not too good. But Smithfield Foods with 12 million hogs or 100, whatever, that would only cost a dollar a hog. So it's affordable and it's manageable for big, those who have the economies of scale, to buy the government. And so they do. Does that sound like an unreasonable hypothesis, Jack?
Yeah, I think it's even worse than that, though. I think it's just corruption. We've seen so much corruption in the last, I don't know, it's been going for a long time, but I think now it's coming out more and more where people can see it. If they choose to see it. And so, you know, I like your rules for, you know, the laws of food, and that is buy food that you know where it came from, your local farmer.
Yep, that would be Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. So if I get the ingredients for my bone tea from the Kimmicks, I have control because I can look in Jack's eyes and see what's in my bone tea. If I'm buying that from Smithfield Foods, I've had absolutely no control at all. So the big question on the table today is how do we regain some kind of control over our food? And what's our food eats, which is the most important question of all.
I think that the simple answer is just to buy as much as you can, as locally as you can.
Think an economy of scale. Yeah, an economy of scale, because one family, they say, well, I don't have a big enough freezer to hold a whole pig. So go in with two or three neighbors. That's the best way to do it. And now, you know, we've been working with different companies and trying to find a good processor, and we use Corralitos right now. So you buy a pig, that's your pig that leaves this property as your pig. So we can get a USDA harvest, and then that gets shipped in a refrigerator truck to Corralitos, and then you call them and they do the custom cutting. And cut and wrap. So that's the best way to do it. And the guys out there at Corralitos, we've been really happy with them. And I love their apple smoked bacon. Oh my goodness. It's very good.
And so that's another element in the localism that you really come to appreciate as well. Because when you go to all of the trouble that you go through to raise your hogs or pigs, You don't want to just send them anywhere, because if you get somebody who doesn't care, or they might throw your meat in with somebody else's meat because they don't care, they don't know you. But if you're dealing with with the local people like Coralitas Market. You can look them in it. Hey, Dave Peterson, is this good stuff? You can say, and you just know you're going to get the good food from that way. But how possible is that? You know, let's look. People say, "Oh, that can't happen everywhere." And why not?
Well, I think there has to farmers have to be allowed to prosper. And they're doing it in Texas by offering them a lower property tax if they have a small farm and things like that assist farmers. And they don't damage the, like the county entities that depend on property tax for income. And it just, it's an all around beneficial thing.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, last week we did a show about the folks in Texas, the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. They went to war and they worked a piece of legislation through the Texas legislature that allows abattoirs without FDA meat inspectors to process meat for people. And in doing so, they kind of opened up the market much wider for the possibility of local meat. And there's a lot of of small producers throughout Texas, and there's a lot of small abattoirs throughout Texas that were prevented from working together because the government stood between them. So
right. And you know, here's the thing. Having to be run by legislation and regulation, these businesses self-regulate. If they produce a bad product, no one buys it. And that happens very quickly.
Very quickly.
They have to produce a top quality product. And they don't do it because they've got someone in with a clipboard telling them how and what and how much. But they do it because they know what they're doing and how to produce the best product.
So that's Texas, and we're in California today, Hollister, California, at the home of California Cua Buta, pasture-raised pork. And California just passed an interesting law regarding pork that is not, is the one thing that won't affect you guys because you don't have your hogs in pens, do you?
We do not.
And so
they're allowed to feel they like.
Yeah. Jack, how do you see that law impacting the overall pork business in California? It's going to make
It's going to be right now that, you know, they've sort of put that law on the back burner because they came up with a law that sounded really good for all those voters, like, oh, give them more space, give them more space. When in reality, they're in those farrowing areas for a short period of time. Those farrowing cages actually prevent the sows from squishing piglets, which in those commercial operations, every piglet is very, very valuable. They can't do without one. When you're out on pasture, every once in a while, the sow's going to squish a piglet. It just happens. It's part of the operation. But this operation, they want 2 more square feet per pig for these confined animal feeding operations. And that's really not going to do much because when our sows give birth, they go and they tear down branches. We actually have a tree service that brings us a bunch of branches. And so they take those branches and they make nests. Looks like a big chicken nest. And they bury into the compost, which has really good bacteria in it that prevent disease and other problems like mastitis. We do not get mastitis out here because they are in so much compost, active compost. So with that, we don't see that. We look over and go, oh, she's having her litter. We leave her alone. Every once in a while in the cold weather, I'll go and I'll put a bale of straw next to her. And then the next time I look at it, it's all fluffed up and she's created a nest and they're all protected. But we won't see the piglets for maybe 2 weeks. And one day she comes trotting out with a whole bunch of piglets behind her. because we just leave them alone. So that law, it's going to cost people a lot of money because these old, the older pig farms that were built up, they're out of concrete. I mean, there's big metal pipes that are, you know, concreted in and welding. And now they have to basically tear that out and start over. And that's a huge expense, especially at today's prices. So we're going to probably see California bacon farmers either dry up or leave the state, and which I think is probably the ultimate plan so they can get their forever impossible meats so that people start buying that stuff. So
for which they have a patent, right? They have the patent on the Impossible Pretend Burgers. So if you have the patent on the Impossible Pretend Burgers, you don't want them eating real meat. You want to do what you can. What is it Rahm Emanuel said? Never let a serious crisis go to waste. Here's an opportunity to force people to eat what we want them to eat. Pretend burgers. Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, what's in your food? They say we are what we eat. Makes sense to me. What we put in our belly is broken down into its constituent elements we call nutrients. Those nutrients are assimilated into our body and they become us. But it's that's true, then it's also true that we are what our food eats as well. And it's an interesting thing to give a consideration to the different things that the Kimmicks feed their hogs at California Kurabuta and what Smithfield Farms feeds their pigs. So what do I need to do to get a half a hog, Sarah?
The best way to do it is to go to the website. Because there are only two of us, we don't put a phone number on the website. Go to the website, and it has a tab that says order form.
There it is. We're out of time, but we can say the website, California Kurabuta. And you'll look it up.
Or BK Meat Club.
Or BK Meat Club. Either way. Get some food with its farmer's face on it and live. Thank you all for tuning in. And stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.